In the 17th century, the gospel was being threatened, and a group of theologians known as the Scholastics wanted to do something about it.
Now, one of the charges always brought against the Scholastics was they were dry, they were dead, and they were deadening. That's just not true. They were tough, but they were profound, and they were helpful. And personally, they were very concerned about piety.
Today on Renewing Your Mind, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey introduces us to some of the personalities of this period in church history. We've been studying with Dr. Godfrey over the past several months here on the Saturday edition of our program. He's taken us on a tour through time, helping us understand the growth of the church from the Book of Acts and now into the 17th century. Dr. Godfrey is a Ligonier Teaching Fellow and Chairman of Ligonier Ministries. Let's join him now.
In the last lecture, we were looking at the challenges that the 17th and 18th centuries were going to face, new challenges, and we talked about the challenge of a renewed theology in the early 17th century, and that renewed theology has often been described as scholasticism. Scholasticism, as a word, is derived from the Latin word schola, meaning school. And what scholasticism really is theology as it's done in the schools. And it has that name because the theology of the schools is different from the theology of the churches. That is to say, theology became much more technical. It developed a technical vocabulary, a very precise way of speaking. Theology in the schools in the 17th century began to depend more and more on Aristotle's philosophy and made use of technical terms out of Aristotle's philosophy. And what this meant was that people trained in Aristotle and trained in this new scholastic theology could quickly communicate with one another, could rather briefly communicate with one another. But it became increasingly a difficult theological form of communication for ordinary people to understand. So scholasticism was not for the churches. It was for the school. It was not for preaching, but was for learned theologians to communicate with one another. It's sort of the difference between teaching chemistry in a high school class to students who are not very technically proficient in the sciences and teaching a PhD class in chemistry at Harvard. You would have a whole different vocabulary. You would have a whole different level of expectations of what people could understand. And that's what happened with the rise of scholasticism. It was a brilliant movement. It was a movement led by some of the most learned men in the history of the church. Men who were learned not only in biblical languages and in the Bible, but very learned in philosophy and in theology and in history. And it led to a remarkable flowering of theological ability to communicate and theological precision for the sake of the church and for the defense of sound doctrine. And so this great flowering of learning in the schools led to volumes and shelves and libraries of remarkably learned material and continued to contribute to the sense of community amongst European scholars. Because in the 17th century, they were still writing in Latin. Latin was still a living language in the 17th century. Scholars could not only read Latin, but they could write Latin, they could speak Latin, and they could think in Latin. Today, there aren't a lot of people who can do that. There are still scholars who can read Latin, but the numbers who can write Latin are much smaller. And the people who are really proficient to speak Latin or to think in Latin are almost non-existent. But the fact that Latin was used in the 17th century meant there was a real community of scholars, an ability of scholars, whether in Switzerland or in the Netherlands or in Germany or in England to communicate with one another. We think that we're a great period of history for communication. We can communicate with people so easily, so quickly, over such vast distances. We think we're in a great state. But of course, the truth is, we can't communicate with people in Germany very well unless they've learned English. We can't communicate with people in Africa or in China very well unless they know English. Few of us know another language. But the linguistic divide of the world is much more serious today than it was for scholars in Europe in the 17th century. We have to have a sense of that, how quickly, relatively speaking, they could read one another, profit from one another, debate with one another. Publishing was relatively fast in the 17th century. Today, to get a book published is often the process of several years. But then, it was a matter of maybe a month. They could set a book very quickly, even though they didn't have any of the technological advantages that we have today. So there was a real community of scholarship, and out of it came literally dozens of really great theological works, the pinnacle of which perhaps was the great three-volume work of Francis Turretin. Francis Turretin was a professor and a pastor in the Reformed Church in Geneva. He lived from 1623 till 1687. So right at the heart of the 17th century is when Turretin wrote and when Turretin taught there in Geneva. And his great three-volume work, The Institutes of Eclectic Theology, even the title is difficult to understand, close to the Institutes of Polemic Theology, it was controversial theology that he was looking at, is one of the great resources of Reformed history. And thankfully, it has been published in the last couple of decades in an English translation. Turretin's Latin was used as the textbook in systematic theology at Princeton Seminary for almost the whole 19th century. And students at Princeton Seminary, still in the 19th century, were expected to be able to read Latin. But somewhere towards the end of the 19th century, there was a student at Princeton who said, you know, an awful lot of my fellow students aren't reading Latin all that well. And he produced an English translation of Turretin. And that has just, as I say, in the last couple of decades, been published in English and is available and is worth the effort to try to read if you're interested in a really precise formulation of a theological topic. Let me read one example from Turretin. We'll see how this goes. He's not easy to read, even in English. But I love this paragraph because I feel so smug when I read it. Do you ever read things and feel really smug? That you know something that no one else knows? I know that volumes of theological works written in the last 20 years would not need to have been written if people had been smart enough to know this one paragraph out of Turretin. One of the big debates that's been going on in recent history is over the covenant of works and the covenant of grace, and how faith and works operate in the covenant of works and in the covenant of grace. And part of the debate came along when Karl Barth said, well, there really shouldn't be seen a great difference between the covenant of works and the covenant of grace because God is Father in both, and faith and works are necessary in both. And so this has led to huge debates about the nature of the covenant. Are there more than one covenant? How does faith relate to the covenant? How does works relate to the covenant? How is God our Father in each? All sorts of debates have gone on about this. And as I say, if people had just known what Turretin wrote in one paragraph, I think all of these things could have been solved. Well, not really, because some people just will not accept the truth. But Turretin has it exactly right here. Now let me read this. Nor can it be objected here that faith was required also in the first covenant, and works are not excluded in the second, as was said before. They stand in a far different relation to each other. For in the first covenant, faith was required as a work and a part of the inherent righteousness to which life was promised. But in the second, it is demanded not as a work on account of which life is given, but as a mere instrument apprehending the righteousness of Christ, on account of which alone salvation is granted to us. In the one, faith was a theological virtue from the strength of nature terminating on God, the Creator. In the other, faith is an evangelical condition after the manner of supernatural grace, terminating on Christ the Redeemer. As to works, they were required in the first as an antecedent condition by way of a cause for acquiring life, but in the second, they are only the subsequent condition as the fruit and effect of the life already acquired. In the first, they ought to precede the act of justification. In the second, they follow it. Now, you got that? You know, if you read it slowly, it's not so hard to follow. It's kind of brief, it's kind of compact, but it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, showing how, of course, faith and works are both in the covenant of works and in the covenant of grace, but in very different ways, operating in entirely different relationships to what is accomplished. This is the kind of thing that you find in the great scholastic writers. This is not the kind of thing you find in popular evangelical work anymore. And because you don't find this kind of precision, you find people talking past each other so often in theological debates today. The scholastics almost always began by saying, when they approached a theological issue, what is the state of the question? In other words, they began by saying, what are we talking about? Do you realize how seldom we do that in our society, whether it's about religion or anything else? What are we really talking about? People just talking past each other all the time because they haven't taken the time to say, what are we really concerned about here? Where's the real point of disagreement here? What do we need to focus on here? And this is what the scholastics were so brilliant at accomplishing and at doing. And they needed this kind of precision, in fact, because there were so many new theological issues coming up. The Reformed had to speak to the Roman Catholics and to Robert Bellarmine. That was one kind of issue. The Reformed had to speak to the Lutherans. There were great scholastic Lutheran theologians, not as great as the Reformed, but still, they were great scholastic theologians amongst the Lutherans. But then also there were growing intra-Reformed disagreements and tensions that had to be addressed. At the end of the last series, you may remember, we talked about Arminianism as a movement that grew in the Reformed churches and had to be addressed theologically within the Reformed churches. In the 17th century, also, there developed a debate inside the Reformed churches, particularly in France, sparked by a French pastor and professor by the name of Amirot. And Amirot's name was given to the movement which became known as Amiraldianism. Amiraldianism came sometimes later to be called four-point Calvinism because Amirot challenged the notion that Christ had died for the elect alone and taught that Christ had died for everyone. And I always say, you know, why be stingy and only have 4 points when you can be full and have five? But that's not a sharp theological argument. Amirot was a clever professor. He argued his case very pointedly, and he had to have a very pointed, a very careful, a very precise kind of answer to what he was doing. And it also helps remind us that these theological issues have much broader consequences often. Sometimes we can say, oh, you know, is it so important to be precise theologically? Does it really matter? Why can't we let some of these things go? Why can't we just like one another? But Amirot's effort to change historic Calvinism reflected a whole strategy on his part for the French Reformed Church. He was a member of the French Reformed Church. And by the early 17th century, the French Reformed Church had come to recognize it was probably permanently a minority church in France. There had been a moment in the 1560s where there was a chance, it looked like, that the Reformed might actually take over all of France. But by the early 17th century, it was pretty clear that was not going to happen. And the Reformed Church had declined to just about 1.5 million members. That's still a pretty good size, but 1.5 million members in France with a population of about 20 million. And the French Reformed said, how do we survive now? How do we live? We're probably not going to take over the whole country, so how do we survive? And there were really two attitudes in the church that developed that later historians have called those who believed in being prudent and those who believed in being firm. Now, this happens in life all the time, isn't it? You have to have a strategy. It even happens in war, doesn't it? We've been fighting in the Middle East. How do you make progress there? Are you prudent or are you firm? Do you take troops out? Do you put troops in? It's always a struggle to know what's the right strategy. And some in the French Reformed Church said, you know, we need to be prudent. We need to make Calvinism sound as attractive and as little offensive as possible. It offends people when we say Christ died only for the elect. We don't need to say that. Let's reformulate our theology in a way that's more prudent, more understandable, more acceptable. Let's get along where we can get along. And then there was the other side in the church in France, the firm side, that said that's just compromise. That will only weaken the church. We need to be clear. We need to be explicit. We need to understand for ourselves why we're different, and we have to uphold our differences. And both of those strategies could be argued for. Both of them potentially made some sense. Neither of them ultimately saved the day for the French Reformed Church. By 1670, the French Reformed Church was half the size that it had been at the beginning of the century. It was under tremendous pressure and declined and eventually would be seriously reduced when King Louis XIV would revoke the Edict of Nantes, which had granted toleration to the Reformed. Louis XIV in the 1680s said, there are no longer any Reformed churches in France, and so we no longer need the Edict of Nantes. I revoke it. Now, of course, that was a lie, and he knew it was a lie, but led to a large emigration of French Huguenots, some of them to America, some of them to England, some to the Netherlands. But here was a theological issue that at first glance might seem rather narrowly focused, but was part of this much broader question. How do we survive as Reformed people when we're a minority? Do we hold up our distinctiveness, or do we try to sound as much like everybody else as we can? That's still an issue for Reformed people today. Do we want to look like all the other evangelical churches, or do we want to be distinct? And there are good people on both sides of those issues, although the firm are right. That's not a historical comment. That's just my own personal prejudice seeping in. So here we have this marvelous intellectual community that's been created, a marvelous accomplishment that is still a treasure trove for the church, largely unknown today, more known today than it would have been 20 or 30 years ago, but still not known as much as it ought to be. Because in the 19th century in particular, there was a great reaction against scholasticism in the churches and in the schools. That stuff's just dead. That stuff's just lifeless. That stuff doesn't really help anybody anymore. We need a whole new energy in theology. We need a whole new way of talking theologically. Change happens. You can't avoid it. But in the process of being critical of scholasticism, partly because Europe moved away from Aristotle and scholasticism seem so linked to the philosophy of Aristotle, they said, well, if we're not Aristotelians philosophically, we really can't learn anything from this old-fashioned kind of theology. In fact, this theology was not that dependent on Aristotle, but that's another big issue we won't get into today. But by the 19th century, especially the later part of the 19th century, scholasticism became a kind of nasty word. And a way to sort of put down your theological opponent was say, well, that's sort of a scholastic argument. That means it's too picky and it's too dead and it doesn't really accomplish anything. And you find even in quite solid reformed circles in the early 20th century, people using the word scholastic as a kind of nasty word, a way to put down your opponent. And it's really amazing that that happened. And we really live in a day in which there is a flourishing, again, of an appreciation for scholastic writing. And a lot of translation has gone on. There's some translation of a great Dutch scholastic theologian by the name of Witsius. His writing is really quite readable and very useful to read. I'm always intrigued, you know, there have been so many Americans who have been so intrigued by the work of Jonathan Edwards as a theologian. And Jonathan Edwards always said his favorite theologian, the best theologian he knew that had preceded him, was Peter von Maastricht. And as far as I know, Edwards scholars have never studied Peter von Maastricht because von Maastricht is only available in Latin. And it's a very turgid kind of Latin. So one of the key sources to the thought of Jonathan Edwards is a source that's almost entirely closed to us. Right now, there's a translation project going on to translate Peter von Maastricht. So I'm sure you'll all want to rush out and get that the minute it's hot off the press. But this is kind of the vitality of the world that we live in, where we can really begin to appreciate anew the scholastic theologians. You have to invest yourself to read them, but the rewards are really worth the effort. Now, one of the charges always brought against the scholastics was they were dry, they were dead, and they were deadening. That's just not true. They weren't dry, they weren't dead, and they weren't deadening. They were tough, but they were profound, and they were helpful. And personally, they were very concerned about piety. And that needs to always be borne in mind. They were great preachers. Francis Turretin was a great preacher. The people heard him gladly in Geneva because he didn't take his theology book into the pulpit and read. He preached to the hearts and lives of the people. He knew the difference between scholastic theology and preaching. He knew the difference between theological graduate students and lay people in the churches. He knew how to change the way in which he communicated from one to the other. And he was passionate about piety and true faith being built up in the hearts of the people. That's what the scholastics were like at their best. And it's worth remembering and treasuring what they've done for us. So that brings us to the conclusion of this lecture. And my parting word would go, go buy a scholastic book. It will improve your theology and help you get to sleep at night all at once.
You know, we hear similar complaints today, don't we, that teaching too much doctrine will leave us with a dead church. Dr. Robert Godfrey helped us strike a healthy balance today here on Renewing Your Mind. His series, A Survey of Church History, introduces us to the important people and ideas that have shaped the church over these many years. In my opinion, it's a must-listen for Christians. We can better navigate the differences among believers when we understand the origins of those disagreements. We'd be happy to send you Dr. Godfrey's series, 73 lessons in all. We've put them all together in a 12-DVD set, and we'll send them to you for your gift of any amount. You can contact us at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us with your gift at 800-435-4343. You may teach a Sunday school class or lead a small group at your church. The lessons in this series are about 23 minutes long, making them useful in a classroom setting. Request a survey of church history for your gift of any amount. 73 lessons on 12 DVDs. Again, our phone number is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. We here at Ligonier Ministries are expanding our international outreach. Interest in Reformed theology is increasing around the globe, and the Internet is one of the powerful tools allowing that to happen. That's why we've made RefNet available 24/7. We'd like to invite you to tune in. We feature the ministries of faithful men like Alistair Begg, John MacArthur, and Stephen Lawson. Plus, you'll hear Bible readings, music, and Christian audiobooks. You can listen for free at refnet.fm, or you can download the free RefNet app. Well, next weekend, Dr. Godfrey continues our series. Another movement rose to prominence in the 17th century. Join us next Saturday for a lesson titled Puritan Piety, right here on Renewing Your Mind.